all of our trucks were placed in the column in the serial right after the 5th Marines command post group. And we were loaded completely with wounded fellas that they were lying in stretchers, I guess, I hope, keeping warm somehow.
Well, now, who gave the order for y'all to withdraw?
Colonel Litzenberg.
Yeah. And was he going to withdraw the entire
yeah.
two regiments?
Well, the maneuver was he got one battalion. Well, he had a company, Fox Company of the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, was on top of the pass and held out the pass against almost overwhelming Chinese assaults. But they didn't overwhelm them. They held out. But they weren't going to hold out forever. So Colonel Litzenberg sent one infantry battalion straight up, almost in column, not to fight a frontal action, but to knife in and relieve that company on the pass. And that was the battalion under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Ray Davis. And they did a wonderful job. Both the officer that held out up there, Captain Barber, and Colonel Davis.
And y'all were in a position where you couldn't anticipate reinforcements.
No, we weren't going to get any reinforcements. And I'm sure that Colonel Litzenberg got the orders to bring the force he had up there out from division. Mm-hmm. Although there is a story that goes around that says we got exactly one message, orders from division, and that was to turn the brown side out on our helmets. We had camouflage cloth covers for our mm-hmm. helmets. One side's green, the other side's brown. Mm-hmm. And we got an order to turn the brown side out in the middle of this thing. And that was, I'm told, the only orders we got from division. Anyhow.
Was there any hidden significance to
no.
turning?
No, it's just that the weather had changed.
Speaking of the weather, how could you function with the weather as cold as it was?
We were equipped with pile-lined parkas, and we had what they called shoe packs, which is like a duck hunter's boot with a rubber foot. And they were oversized, and we had extremely heavy wool ski socks. And those were very effective in keeping us warm. You weren't comfortable, but you were warm. The parka was heavy and really weighed down on the back of your neck, but it kept you warm. We also had Arctic sleeping bags if we got a chance to sleep. I haven't mentioned that it snowed every night. We had about 2 feet of snow. It was kind of like last winter. And the temperature at night reached something in the area of 35 below zero Fahrenheit, with a wind chill factor that took it even lower. In the daytime, it would get very mild. We'd get up maybe up around zero. Which is still 32 degrees below freezing. But it felt like spring. the way I did, in these shoe packs, my feet would get soaking wet. So we'd all been issued extra socks. And I kept a pair of socks in my parka, hanging in the arm sleeves, in the armholes. And they would dry in there. And every now and then, a couple of times a day, I'd just take everything off, take my socks off, put the fresh socks on and parkas on, squeeze the water out of my socks I'd just taken off, and put them in to dry. And that worked. I didn't get frostbite. The other thing that on this movement out was we were under attack most of the time, but not concentrated. At one occasion, we had a concentrated attack in the middle of the night. You couldn't see anything but the flash of muzzle flashes of guns around, and that's what you shot at. Fortunately, we only shot at muzzle flashes that weren't friendly for some reason, and fended off that attack. But you had to stay up all the time. You couldn't sleep. You couldn't drop off. I had a communication jeep which had a radio mounted in it with a little generator, and it kept going, and it was warm in there, and I was out seeing how things were going all the time, and so Marines would climb in my jeep and fill it up. I went in there one time, there were six guys in that jeep. The only guy that belonged in there was the driver. But I'd have to kick somebody out every time I needed to use the radio. But I felt for him. I wouldn't really crowd into the jeep myself unless I needed to. Then we were assigned security for this convoy of wounded also. And so the rest of the battalion was organized into two sort of provisional rifle companies and guarded the flanks. In other words, we kept the high ground on both sides of the road. Well, if there was low ground on one side, we kept the high ground on the high side and kept a surveillance of the low ground below. One occasion, we when dawn came one morning, we spotted some Chinese in a hut down below, and I had a machine gun set up out there. Of course, I was right next to the 5th Marines command vehicles, and Ray Murray saw me setting up this machine gun. He asked what it was for. I said, "There's some Chinese down there." He says, "Cease firing." He didn't want to get things started, I guess. Then another time, we were, after we had passed the Tok Tong Pass, my part of the convoy, we had some mortar fire come in. And I had an interpreter, a Korean guy by the name of Han, H-A-N, and when the mortar round landed, he said, "They shoot at us! I scare like hell!" And I told him, "Yep, they're shooting at us, all right."
Did you have any close calls yourself, personally?
Well, yeah. Well, every now and then.
Anytime they're shooting at you, it's a close call. But you know, the one that...
Somebody had a machine gun trained on our part of this convoy or column. It wasn't really moving fast. We'd move a couple of hundred yards and we'd stop, move a couple. And a burst of machine gun fire went right across in front of me and hit in the bank next to me. And I said, "What the hell was that?" All I thought was something had happened right in the bank and not shooting across me. Then I realized, hell, somebody fired right at us. And never happened again. The other close call, of course, was that firefight in the middle of the night and the mortar rounds. And then we went on after that, and it was downhill into Hagaroo from there. And we were able to get back into the perimeter, at least the part of the convoy I was in with the wounded people, back into the perimeter at Hagaroo without further incident. However, the rest of my battalion, the guys on the in the column with the guns, ran into trouble. The tractors were very hard to start, and so we never stopped them once we got started. We just kept them running idled. And they started running out of fuel after about a couple of days, and we didn't have any fuel for them. So the division service people had left a cache of fuel on the road, just outside of Hagaroo Ri, right about at this bridge. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese had developed a strong point on Hill 1226, and the convoy started running out of fuel. The guns convoy started running out of fuel right at that point, and were taken under attack, and had a very heavy battle. Fortunately for them, the 5th Marines, they had been following the 5th Marines into the perimeter, and the 5th Marines had two of the platoons of replacements from the 4th Battalion 11th, and when they went by, they saw our guys were in trouble. They dropped out of their assignment with the 5th Marines and rejoined their friends. So we had about 50 more guys, as well as the 50 people with the tractors and guns, to help fend off the Chinese. But we did lose a number of men there, and we were driven away. And the guns that ran out of the tractors that ran out of fuel were stalled, and we also lost 9 more guns there. So in all, we lost 10 guns. One of them slid off the road up on the pass and couldn't be retrieved, and those 9 that were lost at the bridge just outside of Hagaroo.
How heavy were the casualties for the entire 2 regiments that were up there in that area?
They're very heavy.
Part of this.
Very heavy. I'd say they lost about half their people. Mm. Yeah. Not all killed, but wounded and ineffective. And some people, a number of people were captured, of course, because of the way that battle went. Mm-hmm. At Hagaroo, the regimental exec, who I later learned was now the regimental commander, something had happened to our regimental commander and he'd been evacuated, was Carl Youngdale. He was still a lieutenant colonel then. Now, all of these guys ended up being generals for some reason. I guess they were good. But Carl greeted me and apparently saw that I was about on my last legs, because I wanted to turn around and go back out and see that the guns got in. And he got me in a tent and took my shoes away and wouldn't let me go. So I went to sleep, and I guess I slept like a baby until the following day, and got up and found we only had 8 guns left, and we were right back where we started when we left Camp Lejeune. Hmm. 8 guns and about 20 officers. And 280 men. Hmm. Just about the same. So, do you want to stop here?
Saipan and
back on Saipan. The second morning after I'd landed on Saipan, there was an alarm spread that the Japanese were going to try to execute a counter landing, and so we all got into foxholes and got our weapons ready to repel anyone coming off the beach. And there was artillery coming into our area. I heard one round coming in and ducked in my foxhole, was showered with sand, and nothing else happened. So when I rose up back out of the foxhole, I found myself staring at the shiny and hot base of a 105 round that had just landed there. Obviously a dud.
Wow.
And that, later on, I got thinking, well, God damn, if that had gone off, I would have been dead. For sure.
Wow. The end of interview number 2. The last segment on Saipan should be moved to its proper location in the narrative.